case for argument this morning is Bowley v. Colvin. Ms. Gilmore.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Monica Gilmore and I represent the appellant Marilyn Bowley. Ms. Bowley's case started out as a typical Social Security claim for disability and supplemental security income benefits. Where it derailed was at the hearing level. She filed her claim for disability benefits and was denied. She filed a request for reconsideration and was denied. Filed her request for hearing and it was dismissed as untimely. The request for review at the Appeals Council was also denied, and based on the Appeals Council decision and the dismissal of the request for hearing, the District Court found that there was no jurisdiction.
What does the record tell us about Ms. Bowley's recurrence of cancer in relation to the 60-day period in which she could request a hearing?
Unfortunately, very, very little, Your Honor, and that is because the Social Security Administration does not accept additional information once it's been determined that the hearing should not be held. So at the time that she had the recurrence, that was whenever her counsel did not receive the copy of the notice of denial of request for reconsideration. At that time, counsel would have submitted the evidence of her recurrence of breast cancer. That's central to the case because it brings in her constitutional due process claim. She hired an attorney to handle her claim for the very reason that she is disabled. All of the case law that Social Security has on this issue, and unfortunately there is quite a lot on this particular type of claim where the person has not been able to have their hearing because of some kind of lack of notice. Some extent of lack of notice existed. In this case, she assumed that her attorney was going to take care of it for her because that's why she hired the attorney. And to add to that egregious error, she had breast cancer and had to have a double mastectomy during the time period. What better reason is there to assume that your attorney is going to take care of things than you are incapacitated by illness? One of the key problems with the way that the Social Security Administration handles things at this point is that it basically throws its hands up and says that, well, you didn't have a hearing, so we don't have to worry about the rest of this. And that makes no sense, because as we can see from the facts of this case and facts of other cases, there are circumstances where there is no hearing, but the claimant still has followed the procedures that are delineated by the Social Security Administration. They should not be punished for following those procedures, and that is unfortunately the way that the law reads right now. It has resulted in an unfair result to Ms. Bowley, and it will result in future unfair results to other claimants. It is something that this circuit has not decided. There are circuits that have held that that's too bad. That's the way the law reads, and we're not going to touch it. And it's our position that that is unfair. It leads into the claimant's right to counsel and the due process violation. It is unfathomable that the Social Security Administration says that we're going to set up, in fact, an entire area of our website devoted to representatives. We are going to have an entire checklist of things that only attorney representatives are supposed to do, but then we're going to say that it's no big deal that the representative did not receive notice of this denial that triggered a deadline. That notice is what triggers the 60 days. And I think that Ms. Bowley's position is that it was error for the administrative law judge to find that good cause did not exist for the due process claim when they did not send notice to her attorney. She relied on the fact that she had retained counsel. Social Security has procedures in place, including a million forms to send out to attorneys, and they copy the attorney on everything that gets sent to the claimant in most cases. Social Security has acknowledged on two different occasions through two different individuals that it was their error that resulted in Ms. Bowley not receiving the appropriate notice through her counsel. This court should carve out an exception where the Social Security Administration is clearly at fault for a hearing not taking place. 405G requires the hearing. Other circuits have held that the hearing is something of a stumbling block, and it's just not appropriate. This case is a perfect example. There needs to be some kind of exception.
Well, I don't think we can create exceptions to statutes. The question here, rather, is whether the word hearing in 405G means only an oral hearing or a final decision by the Secretary using the procedures the Secretary thinks appropriate in the case.
I think that is a very fair reading, and I think that that is something that could be established by this court, is that the finality of the decision from the Secretary is on the same level as a hearing, and that would thereby confer jurisdiction.
A hearing is a hearing. We think that decisions done by district judges by summary judgment are after hearings, but it's a hearing on paper rather than a hearing orally. There are often hearings on paper. That seems to be what the ALJ did here. It received submissions and made a decision on the papers without having testimony. Now, I'll ask the same question to Mr. Schwartz, or Ms. Schwartz, but is there any reason why the word hearing implies only oral submissions and decisions as opposed to written submissions and decisions?
Not from what I can see, Your Honor. It's just that that is the way that it's been done and the way that it's been interpreted. And I think that it would be a fair decision for this court to find that hearing can be defined in different ways, not just with oral hearing and evidence presented. That would definitely have conferred jurisdiction onto Ms. Boley's claim, and it would not have been the issue that we have now. My final point is, what is the purpose for even allowing a Social Security claimant to have a representative if the administration is essentially saying, we don't care that you have one? And that's what happened in this case. Social Security actually is benefited by the existence of attorney representatives. I find it very hard to believe that a claim with an attorney representative is not going to run smoother and have more thorough information available to the administration than one where it is a disabled individual struggling through the process on their own. There are definitely decisions in all circuits that explain, and especially this circuit, that it's a complicated process to go from point A to point B. It's not necessarily impossible, but it is difficult to get through all of the steps, and you have to exhaust all of the steps before you can get to the final decision. Social Security does not differentiate amongst disabilities for purposes of finding someone disabled. You have to be operating under a disability for a period of 12 months. There are definitely listings that go into the details of what constitutes your disability, and there are many cases where the Social Security Administration acknowledges, yes, you are disabled. Unfortunately, you do not meet the criteria for us to find you disabled to receive benefits. So there is an acknowledgement on the part of the administration that these individuals are disabled that automatically puts them in a position where they can benefit from having an attorney representative. I don't think I have anything else to add, so I'm not going to continue to blather on. We request that this case be remanded for instructions that the claimant have a hearing before an administrative law judge. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gilmore. Ms. Schwartz.
May it please the Court, my name is Allison Schwartz, and I'm here today on behalf of the Social Security Administration. I would like to address Ms. Gilmore's argument that there is, with regard to subject matter jurisdiction, that there is no Seventh Circuit case law on point holding that in a situation like this, that there is or is not subject matter jurisdiction when the ALJ denies a request for a hearing or dismisses a request for a hearing. The Seventh Circuit's case in Waters versus Harris expressly held that refused.
Yes, I'm aware of that, but I'm also aware of the Supreme Court's decision in Matthews against Eldridge, which held and could not possibly have been clearer in holding that the only jurisdictional element is presenting a claim to the Secretary. What happens later does not affect subject matter jurisdiction. Now, that's the holding of Matthews, Eldridge properly, because Matthews was the Secretary of HHS, right? The holding of Eldridge. Why isn't Eldridge dispositive of the jurisdictional question?
With regard to Matthews versus Eldridge, that actually triggers the due process issue. And by what you had said, submitting a claim to the secretary,
Look, there is a due process issue in Eldridge after the Supreme Court holds that the federal courts have jurisdiction. The jurisdictional component of Matthews says there is a real jurisdictional part, and that's presenting a claim to the secretary.
There are
non-jurisdictional parts later, like obtaining a final decision after a hearing, but they are not jurisdictional. So how is your contention that not getting an oral hearing is jurisdictional compatible with that part of Matthews against Eldridge?
Matthews versus Eldridge, the jurisdictional part that includes submitting a claim for benefits to the secretary, does not include the hearing on a claim for benefits. It includes the actual application for benefits.
Exactly. That's the holding, that the only thing that affects federal subject matter jurisdiction is submitting a claim to the secretary. Nothing else is jurisdictional. That's the holding. And we have a district judge who said, because the ALJ refused to hold a hearing, there is no federal subject matter jurisdiction. And you're defending that. And that appears to be as incompatible with Eldridge as I can imagine a decision being. So that's why I'm asking you about Eldridge.
Okay. I cannot answer the exact question with regard to Matthews versus Eldridge, although I can say to you that Section 405G requires a hearing, that Section 405G allows jurisdiction only after
Eldridge held otherwise. Eldridge held that the jurisdictional component is the request to the Secretary for benefits. Now, with respect to the statutory language, the non-jurisdictional components, my question, which I asked Ms. Gilmore and I now want to repeat to you, is why do you submit that hearing means only oral hearing as opposed to written hearing or hearing on written submissions? It doesn't say oral hearing. It just says hearing. The ALJ here decided the case after receiving written submissions.
Yes.
Written submissions are received. The ALJ makes a decision. The ALJ says, I'm not going to hold oral, not going to receive testimony orally.
Yes.
Doing it in some other way. What is it about 405G that, in your view, demands an oral hearing as opposed to some other means by which the ALJ reaches a final decision?
Your Honor, I would submit that there is no subject matter jurisdiction in this case under Section 405G.
Would you care to answer my question?
With regard to the actual question regarding Matthews versus Eldridge, I am sorry, Judge Easterbrook, I cannot answer.
On the table.
Okay.
Right. We've established that you don't know that part of Eldridge.
Okay.
The question on the table was, why do you view the word hearing in 405G as meaning only oral hearing? The statute doesn't say oral hearing. It says hearing.
405G requires a hearing as to whether or not an individual is disabled.
Yes. And to repeat my question, mm-hmm. why do you understand that to mean oral hearing? The word oral is not in the statute.
Your Honor, I do not mean that that is an oral hearing. It is a hearing on whether or not an individual is entitled to a claim for benefits. And in this case, Ms. Boley never received a hearing on a claim for benefits because she had forfeited that right to a hearing by not timely requesting one.
The ALJ decided the case short of accepting evidence on the merits.
That's
but it
correct.
Also doesn't say hearing and final decision on the merits of a claim for benefits. Just as a hearing. Right? It seems to me you're putting words in the statute that aren't there, independent of whether these are subject matter jurisdiction words. You're putting in the statute words like oral or like on the merits as opposed to other means of disposing of the claim.
Well,
and those words just aren't there.
Well, in the Supreme Court's decision of Califano versus Sanders, which is instructive here, the Supreme Court held...
Old favorite of mine. I wrote the government's brief in Califano against Sanders.
...wrote that Section 405G does not authorize judicial review of alleged agency abuses in refusing to open a prior application for benefits.
Yes.
That is because the opportunity to reopen a claim for benefits is something that is conferred by the Secretary's regulations rather than by the Act itself. And that would frustrate the congressional purpose in Section 405G, which the Court held imposed a limitation upon judicial review of a Secretary's final decision on the issue of whether or not a claimant is disabled.
I want to take you somewhere else, because just as a logical matter, once a claimant is engaged a representative, a lawyer, why isn't it the representative who counts in terms of evaluating the constitutional sufficiency of notice? I mean, if the regulations require that notice be sent to counsel, why is Ms. Bowley not entitled as a matter of due process to rely on that?
Thank you, Judge Rovner. The agency concedes that it did not send notice to Ms. Bowley's attorney. The agency did send actual notice to Ms. Bowley. That is undisputed in this case. If we put aside subject 405G jurisdiction and look solely at the issue of whether there's a colorable due process claim, whether or not the agency may or may not have followed its regulations is regrettable, but, Your Honor, it does not rise to the level of a due process violation. The question under a due process violation was Ms. Bowley afforded notice and an opportunity to be heard? And this court has not addressed whether notice to a claimant alone suffices as notice under due process, but the Second Circuit has addressed that issue, and it has held that due process does not mandate that both beneficiaries and their representatives be afforded notice, and that notice to the claimant is enough. That district courts in the Northern District of California and Minnesota have ruled in similarly. In this case, it's undisputed that Bowley did have actual notice. In addition, with regard to her due process rights, she also had a meaningful opportunity to present her case. The notice required that she had three opportunities to explain good cause for her failure to request a hearing. And I could see I'm starting to run out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Schwartz. Anything further, Ms. Gilmore?
I would begin with the three opportunities to explain. For practical purposes, in a Social Security claim, the Social Security Administration is the defendant. Her opportunity to explain why she did not make her timely request for hearing was to be made to the defendant, who was then going to make the decision. It's an absurd result.
No, I'm lost. This is the question Judge Rovner asked at the beginning is important to me, too, which is, did your client submit an affidavit explaining why she couldn't have acted based on the notice that she received?
She was requested to submit a letter. She actually was requested to submit an explanation because of her hospitalization. Her counsel submitted that on her behalf. Her counsel was told by the administrative law judge's office that that was insufficient and that he would require a letter from Ms. Boley directly. She then sent in that letter explaining, and that is in the record, that she relied on the fact that she had retained counsel and she believed that her counsel would take care of things for her. That
not an explanation of why the notice to her was insufficient, nor is it an affidavit.
Correct. It did not require an affidavit. It was not requested to be a sworn testimony. It was merely the good cause, I guess I should rephrase, good cause that's required.
You're a lawyer. You're presumably capable of representing somebody and knowing that affidavits are how you put things into evidence, especially if you're contemplating litigation.
This was not in the same context as litigation, and as a matter of fact, the Social Security Administration...
You're building an administrative record in anticipation of litigation, but I don't see any point in pursuing this. Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Gilmore.
Thank you.
Fifth case for...